Jill, a lot of the recent conversation about race and justice in America has focused on the excessive use of police force in African-American neighborhoods. But you argue that for decades, Black communities have actually suffered from too little law enforcement, at least of a certain kind. Can you explain?
Yeah, I do. I do argue that. It sounds like a paradox. I don't think it is. It's a quality versus quantity kind of issue in one sense, and it's also a question about approach. There's a consistent theme if you go way back in American history, particularly into the history of the South, where law enforcement relied on fairly minor crimes as seemingly thinly veiled control tactics. Vagrancy arrests of Black men in the South are kind of the classic case of this, where people were just swept into the criminal justice system simply because they existed and were walking around. At the same time that that was happening, that you see lots of references in contemporary texts from the Jim Crow period of Black-on-black homicide being winked at, being ignored, not being investigated thoroughly, not being prosecuted aggressively. I don't mean to suggest that we're in that environment now, but when law enforcement spends a lot of time on relatively minor offenses, possession offenses, which are basically static, the person isn't necessarily doing something, they're having something, or probation, parole violations, as opposed to aggressively investigating and aggressively prosecuting assault and murder, it first of all looks a little bit the same, even if the reasons for it are different. But I would argue further that it produces the same result, which is a tendency for people to resort to legal self-help, to settle their own scores and ignore law enforcement as a device for mediating quarrels in their societies. Mm. So I think that's what we see in inner city, so-called inner city America in the late 20th century and early 21st.
So you're saying that when you look at police involvement in inner city neighborhoods right now, what we see is police coming through and doing a lot of search and stops for minor crimes, or possession or whatever, but in fact ignoring or not doing enough about homicide.
Right. Well, homicide, it's much more difficult to respond to adequately. It's very expensive and complicated to investigate and successfully prosecute a homicide or a serious assault case. And I really think those things exist along a continuum. And it's part of a whole intellectual framework around policing, I would say. It goes with our emphasis on prevention and this idea of preventive policing. That's what the police are doing when they're doing traffic stops. That's what, so-called broken windows is about. It's about using relatively minor crimes to potentially ward off bigger crimes. But I would question some of the logic of it. And what I argue in the book is that you have to mount a vigorous response to violent acts, or the center doesn't hold. That's the keystone mm-hmm. of the arch. And what you see in places like Los Angeles, and I doubt it's very different in other similar urban environments, is fairly low clearance rates or solve rates for homicide, especially if you look all the way through, did somebody at the end of the process get convicted, and also for serious assaults. Mm.
So when people talk about murder and gun violence in African-American neighborhoods, in cities like Chicago, New York, or your own L.A. County, the word that's often used is epidemic. And your point is that this is an invisible epidemic that we just don't pay that much attention to. So, I mean, how many people are being killed and how?
Well, the U.S. has, maybe somewhere between 14,000 and 16,000 homicide victims a year. Roughly half of those in any given year are Black victims, maybe 40% male Black victims, since most homicide victims are Black. That, of course, is very disproportionate to Black representation in the general population, which is 12-13%. So it adds up to, somewhere around 6,000 deaths of Black men a year. maybe 7,000, 8,000 if you go back into recent memory, especially into the 90s. And in L.A., L.A. looks like the national statistics on paper. The city of L.A. is probably about 8% black population-wise now, but black victims tend to constitute 30 to 40% of all our homicide victims.
Wow. And this is, you call this the wallpaper of urban crime, that there's a way in which we just don't see it. How come?
Well, we see it and we don't see it. And actually, I should say, I think it's changed. Even in the 10 years that I spent doing this in South Los Angeles, I think there was a tangible change in public rhetoric around this issue. And people were, both black and white advocates were much more likely to speak about it in more recent times than when I first started. My experience as a reporter was going into an environment where there was very little press coverage. It was quite understandable why. It's these cases tend to all look alike. They tend to not garner public sympathies in obvious ways. Many times the people who are being killed have a criminal background or a background of gang membership, by no means always, but often. And there certainly has been a tendency in L.A. to sort of sum them up as a gang-related shooting in a part of the city where we're used to hearing about shootings. And it's just hard to sort of organize people's attention around an issue like that when it's happening all the time.
Well, you're sort of saying that, horrible as this sounds, gun violence in inner-city L.A. had become ordinary. Too ordinary to merit column inches.
I think that it's true elsewhere too, that the terms gang violence and urban violence are kind of just an accepted standard of in the panoply of urban problems that we've dealt with for decades and decades in this country. I think most Americans understand that.
So let's talk about the blog. You started back in, 2006 or so for the LA Times, the Homicide Report. And you started it precisely for this reason, because you were concerned that a lot of murders were not being covered by the media. What did you start doing for the blog?
The gimmick of the blog was to try to cover every homicide in the county. It's at that time, in fact, when I first started, LA County was right around 1,000 homicides a year. Now I believe it to be in the 500s. It's changed that much in that short a period of time. So at that time, I was dealing with 2-3 homicides a day. I would give each one roughly the same short coverage. I would say the gender, age, race or ethnicity of the victim, where and what had occurred, update to the extent I could. And if I had a driver's license photo, and by the way, many, many of the victims I covered did not have a state ID or driver's license, so that was not always something I could do. I would put it up there in a short blog post. And the idea was to sort of weigh them equally.
And you were going into the neighborhoods for this, right? You weren't taking police information and sitting in your office and just reprinting it.
No, I mean, I did use I was in close contact with the coroner's office. And in fact, the LA County Coroner's Office worked very assiduously to help me with this and to provide a sort of updated lists and, made regular stops at the detective units, especially the busier ones that I covered. But I mostly worked out of my car and drove to scenes and collected what I could about the people who were dying.
How did you even begin to deal with the relentlessness of the murders? I mean, the amount of grief you must have had to encounter.
You know, the homicide report was really one of the last things I did on my 6-8 years on the police beat for the Los Angeles Times. And it was easier than other things because I was dealing with people for the most part immediately after the homicide, actually the day of or the day after. And people are so in shock.
Why would that be easier?
It is easier because people are in denial. They're in shock. They are disbelieving. They have not yet seen what this is going to mean and how it's going to redefine their lives. It's actually much more painful in some ways to go to somebody a year later or 2 years later or 5 years later. Those are the interviews that end up lasting for 6 hours, where the person has been through such a journey of pain that it takes that long to really hear what this means, that initial moment. And it's interesting because that's the moment that in the daily work of a reporter you most often encounter. People are almost in a breathless state, and a lot of things are happening. Funeral arrangements are happening. You're one more professional to be dealt with in their lives. It's quite different to see the long-term impact and go back later.
What were the hardest interviews you did?
You know, I don't know why some things get to me more than others, but in my book, I talk about the father of the one of the main victims I discuss in the book, who's a homicide detective, a black homicide detective who's lost his son. And he says to me in the course of reporting the book, it's something that he hadn't admitted earlier, which is that he lived in a high crime area partly because he, out of a sense of duty, that he believed a police officer should live in the community that he polices. And that completely undid me. That was one of the hardest things I have ever taken in one of these interviews for some reason. I guess it felt to me that it so implicated the whole city. I could go down a list. There's so many painful things that you hear. I had another father of a victim tell me that that he felt responsible for his son's death, because as he put it, I've always lived in the low bottoms. I've always been a poor man, and I've never been able to earn enough money to get my son into a safe neighborhood. So I failed him. He said I wasn't man enough to get my son out of this neighborhood.
The stories that got me in your book, it's the mothers. I guess because I'm the mother of a son myself. And
well, mothers suffer uniquely. It's really, you really do see that. They all family members. You can. People will describe it as dismemberment a lot. They'll use a dismemberment metaphor. I lost an arm. I lost a leg. And you usually see that with siblings and parents. We'll talk about people who are maybe a little one circle out will not use a dismemberment analogy. But the mothers, you know, you really see that they are their children. And so in the years, a lot of the people I've talked to over the years have been single mothers. Sometimes they don't have very many children. Sometimes it's just that one son. And the single mother whose son is everything to them, who comes to a point in her life and that young adult son is taken away. She'll often describe herself as kind of walking in a nether world, almost not quite alive. I'm not here is something that she might say.
This reminds me of one of the moments in the book you're describing. An L.A. homicide detective, John Skaggs, is walking into the home of a woman named Barbara Pritchett, and her son, Devon Harris, has been murdered. I don't know, maybe you could describe that scene.
And he gives her the shoes of her son, which have been in the evidence locker. Paramedics generally take off shoes when they take people in an ambulance, and so they were at the crime scene. He brings them back to her in a box a year later after, when the case is ready to go to trial. And she smells the interior of the shoe. She holds it up to her face to get the stink of her son's feet in the shoe. And as she catches that smell and remembers him, and she collapses.
You focused a lot on the detective in that case, who had to just stand there while she cried, and he's had to do that kind of thing a lot. So tell us about him, this guy John Skaggs. Why did you decide to focus on him?
Well, you know, I by that time I had very concrete ideas about the thesis of the book and what I wanted to explore, and that was specifically the vigor of the state's response to violence. And so he was somebody who really personified that, and particularly personified that in the case that I explore, in the murder of a colleague's son. And so he's a highly energetic individual. He's a supremely confident individual. I say in my description of him that He's quite full of himself, but his arrogance is internal. It's no one else sees him as being particularly distinguished. He doesn't occupy a high position in the police department. He's not working in a division or precinct that's considered sort of central to the city's activities. It's kind of a backwater.
And we should mention that he's white.
Proud of it. And he's white. He works in Watts. And he's had years and years to kind of toil against this very high caseload, the high volume of cases, and a very, you know, consistent types of cases where it's black-on-black homicides, lots of them summed up as gang violence with reluctant witnesses. And so he becomes a real specialist in this particular kind of murder, which I argue is the plurality. It's the big concentration of murders in America, what we should be amassing our best forces against, but what tends to end up being kind of marginal homicides simply because they're not the public's focus.
Well, and they present particular challenges
for
the police. Yeah. So let's talk about this one. The main case that you focus on and you follow Skaggs through this, it involves the young guy named Bryant Tunnell, who's walking down a street in South L.A., warm spring evening, 2007. What happened?
And a car pulls up in the corner. A young assailant jumps out of the car and points a gun and shoots him. He falls on the lawn, and somebody near the scene runs a couple blocks away and gets his father, Wally Tonelli, who's an LAPD homicide detective. The father drives over and ends up being the first detective on the scene. Mm. He sees his son lying there as the paramedics are gathering. So,
wow. And why was Bryant Tunnell murdered? Was he targeted, or was it more of a wrong place, wrong time?
This is something about a homicide. First of all, a lot of homicides aren't solved, and so you never really know what happens. But even if they are solved, my experience of people who are convicted of killing other people is that they don't reveal a whole lot. It's hard to really tell. They don't always tell the truth. And so in this case, we really don't know. I mean, what we do know is that Bryant had no criminal record. He was not in a gang. He was probably an easy target because of where he was living and what he was wearing. We see in L.A. a lot of sort of simmering gang rivalries and tit-for-tat shootings. And in this case, it may just have been that the rival gang had ridden into the neighborhood and was looking for a likely target, i.e. a young black man, because so many of the young black men in that neighborhood were in the rival gang. And it didn't really matter that Brian wasn't. He was good enough. He was a good enough proxy to send whatever message they were trying to send. There may have been something else going on. They may have actually mistaken him for someone else or had a previous quarrel immediately before the murder. But we don't really know. It's really hard to get good, solid narratives out of people in situations like this.
And then one of the really difficult things about cases like this is just tracking down witnesses and getting people to admit that they saw what happened. Why is that so hard?
People are afraid, and there's very few cases relative to the volume of actual violent retaliation against witnesses, but there's enough of it, just a teeny bit is enough to really scare people. And there's lots of what I refer to in the book as message sending. There's a lot of kind of implicit intimidation that goes on, hard stares, cars idling in front of your house, rocks being thrown against your windows, Molotov cocktails are rampant in these neighborhoods where you'll be home in the evening and bang, some flaming bottle comes through the window. So things like that really serve to enforce this idea that you're not supposed to cooperate with law enforcement and you should be scared if you try to.
What about for you as a reporter? Would witnesses talk to you?
No, and I didn't press witnesses necessarily to talk. They were so frightened, and people would beg me to not write down that they were that there was anyone at the scene, or to even suggest that they might have seen it. I had one woman who just about tore my shirt off. You know, she was hanging on my sleeve, begging me not to say that that I'd seen her. And so you have to be very, very careful about that. Even witnesses in trial who had agreed to testify, I'm actually quite careful in the way I talk about them in the book. And as a reporter, I always had to be cognizant of their safety issues.
Mm. What about once the police have a suspect? Well, for instance, in this case, Detective Skaggs wound up with a suspect, Devin Davis, who did actually do the shooting, but isn't going to confess. What kind of techniques does Skaggs use to try to break down a suspect like this?
You know, I think that all detectives have their own personal style, and John Skaggs has his particular style. I found that style particularly ironic in his case because Skaggs is, to use a tired phrase, a real go-getter. He's a very aggressive guy who one of his big pet peeves is anybody who procrastinates or hesitates about anything. He kind of has this internal code about always having every action you take be something that moves you one step forward. But when he interrogates people, he does just the opposite of this. He wanders around and he's discursive and he gets off point and it becomes very boring and it's a conversation that circles and circles and kind of drives people crazy in a way.
Is he trying to bore them to death?
That's right. And that's what one of the colleagues call it. It's the boring them to death. But he's actually very busy as he's doing that. He's thinking, he's strategizing, he's calculating, he's watching his subject very carefully. He's trying to figure out, you know, he'll adjust what he's doing and what he's saying depending on how they're reacting. So a lot is going on. And I describe him at the end of that interrogation as just being physically exhausted because it's such a, he's in this hyper alert state as he's doing it. There's a couple other really interesting things about the way John Skaggs does his job that I think are important. One is that his main tactic, especially with witnesses, is to be reassuring. And that's very important because it tells you it's not about bullying people. It's not about figuring out cases and being super smart and being Sherlock Holmes and deducing. It's about convincing people that it's okay to do this. And just by personality type and I think by presence, he really excelled at that, at just convincing people that they could put everything on him and he would take care of it.
Hmm. That's so interesting because I guess a lot of people think that detectives in tough neighborhoods like this will rough people up or that the interrogations will be brutal in some way or other. Did you see any brutality, any intimidation when you were watching any of the detectives work?
No, I didn't see any brutality. I think you would report that if
yes.
You saw it. Of course, the first Supreme Court cases outlawing that were, I think, in the 40s or 50s. So we have a long history of imposing constraints on law enforcement, especially in L.A., where we've had, two separate renditions of five-year consent decrees on the police department. They really do operate within constraints. In terms of just being harsh in tone or harsh in things, I have seen people do that. And I think it's arguably an acceptable tactic in some situations, but I do notice that the more experienced and effective detectives, especially the ones who've been doing it 15, 20 years, tend to be the least harsh. And certainly Rick Gordon and John Skaggs and Wally Tonelli are, you know, what stands out about them is they're just almost eerie calm and self-control. It's very measured the way that they speak. It's very conversational, and they don't resort to that kind of thing at all. Even lying, which is allowable for detectives legally in interrogations, is something that one of Skaggs' colleagues told me. He said, I just really keep it to a minimum. You can't deal with the people that way. You've got to get them to go along with you. It even in an interrogation, it can be kind of a trust issue. And so it's interesting to see that these really high-performing craftsmen are the ones who are the least harsh, in my opinion.
But it's interesting considering that L.A. County is where, up until recently, one of the most notorious cases of police violence, the Rodney King beating, happened, led to widespread riots. Sounds like things have changed a lot at the LAPD.
Obviously they have. We've had a federal consent decree over the department for basically the whole first decade of the 2000s. We had the Christopher Commission report. We had the Rampart Board of Inquiry. There have been even before Rodney King, decades of efforts to reform professional standards and internal policing within the LAPD. It's very, very hard to measure But I think that most people who have a deep understanding of the department do believe that, for example, discretionary violence, the idea of roughing people up to teach them a lesson, which once used to be very widespread in all of American law enforcement, particularly in the mid-20th century, is not something that is very easy to get away with in the LAPD today.
I guess I'm wondering, sounds like things are very different than, let me rephrase that. So what did you think, how did you respond then to the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson or Eric Garner in Staten Island? I mean, given the amount of time you'd spent with police detectives in L.A., what did you make of those cases?
Well, police shootings on the job are a particular case of homicide, a particular type of homicide. I'm actually not a specialist in those kind of cases, although they have been among the mix of cases that I've covered and obviously covered as part of the homicide report. You know, if I were doing that story right now, I was thinking about this morning, I would. The thing about homicide, and particularly the very, very small percentage of homicides that are police shootings, is that you're always dealing with small numbers. You don't have to just look at a math problem. You can really go in deep and understand it. I would love to take all of the police, the fatal police shootings that have occurred in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, and look at every single one of those cases and examine the circumstances that led to them, examine what went on. Because I don't have that information in front of me, it's hard for me to really make an assessment about what trends are and what's changed. But I would say that that's the way to do it. The way to do it is to really have a deep understanding of all the abetting conditions that exist when these things happen.
Mm. We were talking about trust and the police trying to build trust with the communities they're covering. But, you know, with the epidemic rates of murder that we're talking about in these neighborhoods, this many unsolved homicides, there must be a lot of anger directed toward the police, a lot of lack of trust.
I once interviewed a man whose mentally ill father had been murdered, and that homicide was unsolved. And he had always felt that it had been barely investigated. It was during the years when there were very high homicide rates in LA. And he said that a little bit of an underground character in any way, this person. And he said that to mark his father's birthday every year, his dead father's birthday, that he marked that date by mouthing off to a police officer to sort of express his outrage on behalf of his father about that unsolved homicide. And I always thought that was an interesting story. And, of course, for the police officer on the receiving end, he or she has no idea what provoked this, but he would do this every year. He would instigate some argument with the police officer.
But you must have heard a lot from people, you know, yeah, the police aren't going to do anything about this. They don't care. We're black.
Yeah, that is a something that you hear almost on every case, on every crime scene that you stand around in a crowd at. It's a pervasive feeling. The phrase "one less gang member" is something that you hear people say a lot, cynically, sort of trying to characterize what they think the outside world is thinking when their sons are killed.
So what do you, I mean, you've spent a lot of time on both sides now. You've spent a lot of time with the police detectives. You've spent a lot of time in particular neighborhoods talking with families and witnesses. Where does communication break down between these two groups of people? They both care about crime. What is it they're not understanding about each other?
It's amazing the intersection points. They're in agreement about a lot. You know, there is a ton of work that I think can be done with conduct, with just the way police talk to people. As I've said before, the one thing that really makes my hair stand up is certain kinds of rudeness, which it seems trivial. I mean, what does it matter if somebody's rude? But I actually think rudeness is a huge issue, and you can address a lot just by training police officers to do what they call the dust off well. You know, I'm sorry for the inconvenience today, sir. You can turn around and put your hands down. This is why we hemmed you up against this wall. This is the radio call we got. This is what was happening. We know that it was scary what we just did, etc. Things like that make a huge difference. But in general, I would say that this is bigger than the police department or the so-called communities that they work in. I think that a general public mindset that the police should be predicting or preventing crime is actually more of the culprit here than any, even some of the very counterproductive attitudes that you sometimes see within police department.
What do you mean?
Is shaping the whole thing. I mean, for all through the 90s and into the 2000s, what was it that was forming the contours of police bureaucracies? Well, it was the COPS program. It was getting more uniforms on the street. It was saturation policing. It was targeted policing. It was broken windows. It was sort of this, I think, really unexamined idea that it's a great thing to police with data and to, you know, target neighborhoods and saturate them with uniformed officers without really asking, well, what are those uniformed officers doing when they go to the neighborhood to saturate it, to respond to crime, to respond to data? Well, of course, they're just stopping and searching people as opposed to standing back and saying, you know, really what police are doing is enforcing the law. What is law? Why do we need it? How do we build it? And that's the reason I focus on violent crime in my book and the response to violent crime, because in terms of building legitimacy, that is the state's first job, is to catch killers. And that has not been the public discussion. It's not been our discussion as a nation around this problem.
So would you suggest that a better policy would be to lighten up on the preventive work, lighten up on checking on the windows and respond and searches, and instead double down on trying to solve unsolved homicides?
Probably in the real world, this is a continuum. Probably in the real world, there's always going to be a balance between preventive and what I call responsive policing and what others would call reactive policing. But what I would say is it's absurd to expect things to get better in a neighborhood where, as in the case of South Los Angeles, there were from the late 80s to about 2005, 2006, the last time I did this analysis, 40 unsolved homicides per square mile, with some blocks having 3 unsolved homicides in a dozen years and a single intersection on east of the 110 freeway that had 8 homicides in 12 years, all of them unsolved. When those are the facts on the ground, when that's the environment, you cannot build an effective legal structure. You cannot let those things go.
Why aren't those murders being solved?
You know, I mean, the solve rates are, to be generous, probably around half, maybe a little more than half, but it's just not enough. You've got to get really close to, you know, in some of the wealthy Western countries of Western Europe, they have 80-90% solve rates for homicide. If we're lumbering along down in the 50s and the 60s, especially when crime is so concentrated, especially when we still have so much hypersegregation, which sort of amplifies everything, you're just not going to get there. You're not going to get to building a lawful environment.
So what do the detectives like John Skaggs, a guy who's really driven to try to solve cases, what does he think would help?
You know, one of his great merits, I think, and actually something that's part of the personality type of a lot of effective law enforcement officers is that he's not really reflective and he's not really a broad thinker. He's a very, very focused thinker. And what he thinks about are cases and how to solve them. And that's exactly what you want for someone like that. I mean, I think part of the reason he cooperated with the book is that he had a general sense of the same thing that I'm talking about, that homicide investigations do matter and they do sort of build trust and establish a new set of facts on the ground, which is that you will be punished if you kill somebody. But it's not something that he talked about a lot. In fact, after he read the book, he said to me, he referred to it as the book about the case and all the filler, meaning all that other stuff, which was the thesis and the history and all the other things that I try to cover in the book. To him, that was all just filler because he's somebody who focuses on the concrete details of cases. Thank goodness we need people like that because they actually function well in their jobs.
Yeah, but I guess I'm asking, what would it take to solve more of those homicides?
I mean, to me, the first thing it takes is making it a priority and talking about it and talking about issues like witness intimidation. I mentioned in the book that if you look in scholarly databases for the word witness, what you're going to find is mostly things from the other side, articles arguing that that witnesses are unreliable, that eyewitness evidence can't be trusted. You don't see a lot of what I see every day, which is what do you do about the fact that people are getting rocks thrown at their houses and there's hundreds of Molotov cocktail attacks throughout the county. How do we address those things? Even though I think what I'm talking about is real as well. So you see that there's a neglect, there's an intellectual neglect here. And the starting point is to talk about it, to examine these issues, to ask exactly the question that you just asked, which is, can we push up these thresholds? Can we have a more effective response to violence?
Jill, thanks.
Thank you.